Good evening, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting to order today. Board of Supervisors meeting. We appreciate y'all for being here on March 17th. It is 6:30, and we will stand. We'll start with the pledge. Everyone, please remain standing, and then we'll have the invocation by Pastor Chuck Adams from the Carpenter's House.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Let's pray. Father, thank you for leaders and leadership. Thank you for those who have been willing to use their gifts of leadership and step to the front to provide that leadership for those who abide in the areas that they govern. We pray that as the discussions and the deliberations of this evening unfold, may they lead us to the place of continued health and prosperity that we presently enjoy. We ask this in the name of our Lord. Amen.
Thank you, Pastor Adams. Thank you for being here. Okay, it's time now for public comment. This is for anything that's on the that is not on the agenda. Are we going to do the presentations? Okay, I'm sorry. Presentations first. Okay, we'll start off with Teresa.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. forgive me, I am going off my phone notes. And then also some other. Thank you. We as a community decided to come together around, we thought this was the perfect opportunity because it's one Ag Day, National Ag Day is tomorrow, but then also March is National Nutrition Month. So what we thought would be a great way to celebrate this is to show you a project that we are working on that covers both those areas in only a way that Stanislaus can. So I'm going to try to move through this pretty quickly. So of course, the major concerns for Stanislaus County, like most places in California, through nutrition are heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and cancers. And of course, in Stanislaus alone, we had almost over $1 billion in healthcare costs just due to these, medical bills related to obesity. So then something we're very proud about is our local ag economy. Obviously in Stanislaus, that our ag economy is the mainstay. In fact, we have our ag economy is larger than most states. I've highlighted the vegetable crop sales for this year because that's more directly relating to the program that I'm going to talk about in a second. But of course, we produce crops year-round, we feed the world, but unfortunately, we have not always been able to connect those dots between our farmers and our community itself and our schools and other institutions. So this program was put together in order to fill that gap. So we want to link the community to our farming to agriculture and through school nutrition services, school-based farm stands, farmers markets, and also the retail environment. So the most important thing that we were really concerned about is common messaging across the community. So in what the big picture of this is, when a child comes home from school, they will have Harvest of the Month newsletters and different advertisements for stores and farmers markets that will be showing them what the commodity is for that month, how they can use it, give them some recipes and easy ways to put it all together. So a large group across the community, both government agencies and schools, as well as restaurants and farmers got together, and we started to put this all together. And our first goal was to put together this Harvest of the Month calendar. So I'm going to explain this a little bit. So the middle, of course, we have the months, and in the middle is kind of a large commodity like citrus for January. And then we'll have a highlight. Well, we did this because our goal is if everyone is buying mandarins in January, our hope is that we will buy them all out and you'd be using them within our community. It's a lofty goal, but I think we can do it. And then, of course, February root vegetables and beets, and right, and this month is kale. So we pretty much hit the ground running with this project. So already we're looking at over 8,000 students in the K-8 that we have served with this, and almost all of our Head Start sites have joined on as of the first of the year. We are already in every city within this within the county. And just to show you these pictures, so these, of course, are kids eating healthy. Below is actually, that is from Salida School District. If you don't recognize what's in there, we have local kale and chard. Okay, so the tomatoes, probably local because they were canned. So we're going to just say that they were local because I'm pretty sure they were canned locally. So that's going throughout all of, not only Salida, but Denair also uses Salida and Stanislaus Union. So in another one of our pilot projects that we just started with Costless in series, this is very exciting. So what you're looking at here is sales figures for last year before we started the Harvest of the Month promotion within the stores. And then this year is in the red, which maybe we should have put in the black, but it shows that, I mean, obviously jicama, although we do have some farmers, you know, that are growing jicama, but as of January, December and January, that was all local produce. So we are showing that through the promoting in the stores and doing tastings and just having basically signage within the stores and within the schools surrounding there, that store, we are showing increases in sales, which also means that we are also having increases in consumption of those fruits and vegetables that we are promoting. So along with the, of course, the stores, we wanted to make sure that this was going to be profitable and doable for our farmers. So we've been working very closely with La Rosa and Sons out of Houston. They, in just the past year, just due to this program, have sold over 20,000 cases of produce just to schools. They've done this through food service, but also they've been running some in series, the farm stands, school-based farm stands. So what's very exciting about this with them is, like a lot of our farmers in our area, farming has not been able to be, it's not their full-time job. However, since they've started to promote to schools and to the community, our local community, they have brought back two of their family members to the farm full time. They've also been working directly with schools in order to work on their cropping system so it fits more in line with what the schools will need when they need it. So they actually pulled out a bunch of a large percentage of peaches to put in other fruits that would be more available for the schools. So what is our plan next? Obviously, we're showing our, in these early stages that this is working. So we want to increase, of course, retail, because that, I think that is probably one of the main goals. It's going to, that's really getting our, this local fruit and these local fruits and vegetables out to the community. We're working now on local restaurant promotion with Greens Market and with some of the other local restaurants. So they'll be using fresh produce and our local produce and advertising that. We're looking at starting a mentoring program for food service directors, because unfortunately we have some shining stars within this our community of food service directors that have been using our local produce, but we also have some that are a little scared and don't quite know how to do some of that yet. And so we're going to be putting those food service service directors together with the ones that are doing it and make it happen countywide. And then, of course, community education is always a big piece of this, and teaching the community not only where their produce is coming from and the seasonality of it, but how to use it and how to cook it, because that's always an issue, especially when you're talking about stuff that maybe people aren't quite as keen on, but is very good for them. So, and for more information about this, you can contact myself or Gowrie, and if you have any questions, we're more than happy to answer those.
Any questions for Teresa?
I have a question. You've had such good success reaching out to, like, the markets and the restaurants. Who's going out and visiting with them, trying to convince them? Is it just...
We are. So there, I showed a list of the different agencies that are all working together to do this. We have every quarter more people are joining. I think it's at a really good time to be pushing and doing this kind of work because of all the restoration downtown as with the farmers coming in that Modesto's doing. So there's definitely an interest. And I do think we're at, everyone is really focused on eating locally. And so we're kind of jumping on that bandwagon and really pushing that through Stanislaus because why not? I mean, we have the best produce in the world. We have the best agriculture in the world. Not very many places can you go where everything can be grown in your own backyard or you walk down the street and they're growing, there's a large farm growing it for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would just say that Stanislaus County has over 200 different crops grown in this county, and you won't find very many counties in the United States that even come close to that, only the Central Valley. Some places I think you can grow corn, wheat, and soybeans, I think is about your only choices.
Truly. But
what we have is very exceptional here.
And unfortunately, our youth are not aware of the produce that is here within our county locally. So we need to change that.
Very good. Okay. Teresa, if you'd like to come up here, we have a proclamation for you here. Thank you for all you do through the Cooperative Extension. We appreciate everything you're doing here. And so we have two proclamations here on behalf of the Board of Supervisors. One is for our proclaiming March 2015 as Nutrition Month in Stanislaus County. And then our other one here is proclaiming March 18th, National Agricultural Day in Stanislaus County. So thank you for everything you do. Anything else you'd like to say? Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, next up, Kenny Friedman. Hi, Kenny, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you, Chair Withrow and members of the Board of Supervisors. I'm Kenny Friedman. I'm president of the Boys and Girls Club of Stanislaus County. And with me tonight, I have a few of our board members, Dave Gianelli, Mary Ann Sanders, and Jeannie Olson. About 3 years ago, there were a bunch of us that were members of Commonwealth, plus the Chamber of Commerce, was thinking about the same thing. We were feeling that there wasn't enough here for our kids to do or after school activities. So we kind of converged and we decided there were certain things that we wanted. We wanted some organization that was really into child development. We wanted sustainable programs. We wanted proven models. And we wanted assessment tools to find out if we were doing the right thing. So with a lot of research, we found out that that's exactly what the Boys and Girls Club do. That's the programs that they have. They're proven programs. So we brought them into the community. And by the way, we were the largest city in the United States that didn't have a Boys and Girls Club. Normally, a Boys and Girls Club, when they come in, they require that you build a gymnasium. $6 million? We were all going, we don't have $6 million, nor do we think we can raise it. But Dave Gianelli said there has to be another way, so we started visiting other clubs, and we found that one of the seamless ways to do it is to do the after-school program. So we hooked up with Selvin School District. We started in the two schools there, Selvin and Coleman Brown, both Title I schools, plus free and reduced lunch. High gang activity in that area, and that's where we wanted to be. So we started with those programs, and after 1 year, we measured, and we found that over 80% of the students that were regular attendees improved in at least one core subject. So we went back, we assessed, we proved ourselves, and we are just so excited about what we've done. We've reduced reading lists. We've moved over to Somerset Junior High. We're in negotiations right now with the King Kennedy Center. And so the other thing that we've done is, because we're a nonprofit, we partner with nonprofits. So we've partnered with Backpacks.
Blessings.
Blessings in a Backpack. Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts have troops with us, and we've also worked with an arts group. So we feel that we've done a lot to change our community, and our motto is be amazing. So just to show you a little bit about our club.
Dreams are the building blocks of future progress.
When I grow up, I want to be a paleontologist.
I want to be a veterinarian.
I want to be a businessman.
Singer, a police lady, and an actor.
I want to be a football player.
I want to be a neurologist.
When I grow up, I want to be a dance teacher.
I want to be a marine.
Teacher, singer, and a dancer.
I want to be a pediatrician.
At Boys and Girls Clubs, we help kids find their dreams. We teach them to be amazing. We provide the tools to help them overcome challenges, find their true potential, and build the confidence needed to achieve their dreams. Amazing people live their dreams. Join others in our community who dared to dream, jumped their hurdles, conquered their fears, and are now living their dreams.
My dream is to be able to influence maybe a little girl, a little boy somewhere who's in kindergarten who thinks maybe they can't do this, but, you know, one day I want maybe to meet somebody whom I influence.
If I could have a conversation with my younger self, I might not tell him anything. Instead, I might ask him for advice. There's something really amazing about the imagination and the dreams of a child. They're limitless. And when we grow up, we start to limit those dreams. But when you're a kid, you know you can do it.
Be amazing means to follow your dreams, to follow your passions, to challenge yourself. If you see a task that seems insurmountable, just take it in bite-sized pieces, climb up the hill one step at a time, and you'll look down and look back and realize you've climbed that mountain.
I think my dream right now would be to be the best. And I don't say be the best just in football. I think be the best at everything I do. And whether that's being a person, being a football player, if it ends up being a businessman, or in other people's cases, a musician or a scientist, whatever it is, for me right now, my dream is to be the best at everything that I do.
You know, being a kid is so much fun. If I could rewind my life and be a kid and go back so many years, I would have to just tell myself to try anything and everything out there. There's something for everyone. And if one person can do it and you can't, that's fine. Move on to the next, because there's something for you. And never give up, because if you keep trying your hardest, you'll be able to accomplish it. And you'll be able to be amazing at whatever you do.
We are defined by our surroundings. No matter who we are, where we come from, it really defines who we are. You can stretch outside of that, or be given tools, or be given permission, or opportunities to see other things outside our small community, or whatever the heck it is. Our limitations of our surroundings, I think, you can be tremendous, you can be amazing, you can do a lot of things that are well outside your comfort zone that you didn't even know existed before. And who knows who was sitting side by side. You know, as I grew up in the best, I was sitting next to the next, you know, brain surgeon, and the guys that cure cancer next to me, if you believe it to be true. To make manifest your own destiny, that ultimately is why I think being amazing is.
Won't you help us help our kids be amazing? Let's show them that nothing is impossible if they learn to live their dreams.
Please join me in supporting the Boys and Girls Clubs of Stanislaus County.
Great futures start here.
We are your future!
Be amazing! Come on, it's awesome! Just be amazing.
Thank you.
I say,
and I don't miss it.
It's been a while since you've been up here. Yeah. Well, on behalf of the Board of Supervisors, Kenny, one thing I want to say that's great, you mentioned King Kennedy Center out there, and I know we're working on getting that one started out there, and so you guys are doing great work. Yes, that's right. And we're very excited about it, and we think it's fair, as a part of, you know, this board is committed to the focus on prevention this year, and so... and for many years to come. So, and this is a big part of what we're doing too. So we appreciate all you're doing. And on behalf of the Board of Supervisors, thank you very much. Okay, very good. Next up, Rick Santos. Rick from Stan Soil. Rick, I always like to point out, you know, there are two jobs that people look at. They look at me all the time and they say, you know, I don't know how you can be an accountant. I don't know how you can do that job with the numbers all the time. But then I say, you know, the job worse than that is actuarial. And Rick is an actuarial. So.
I get confused sometimes with accountants and actuaries, so I know how that goes. So you save the dry stuff for last, the boring stuff. This is helping out put you to sleep here. But thanks for having me. Thanks for letting me come and share Stan Sarah's recent successes. And I hope it will be interesting for you today. So I'm going to just give you a brief rundown. This is a very, you know, also I'd like to say, I'd like this to be interactive. So if you want to ask questions, I'd really like you to ask questions as we go through this. So we're going to start off with the funded ratio of the plan. And mind you that this information that you see in this report, the actuarial report that just came out is as of June 30th, 2014. So it is the most recent set of numbers that we have for you. As of June 30th, 2014, the plan was 87.5% funded. We had assets equal to about $1.77 billion and liabilities just north of $2 billion, which leaves us with an unfunded liability of about $253 million. This is actually down from a high of about 5 years ago when we had an unfunded liability of $600 million. So we've made tremendous strides since then. Obviously, the greatest factor here has been the investment returns that the system has experienced over the last 5 years. Mind you, too, that these numbers don't include the fact that we have about $150 million in what you'd call a rainy day fund. Some of it is in, we use what it's called a smoothed asset value to calculate employer contribution rates, and so that money is actually left out of the calculations when the actuary calculates the contribution rates. And that's about $130 million, and then Stan Sarah has another $20 million in an off-balance sheet account. No, I shouldn't say off-balance sheet, but a non-valuation reserve that's sitting there, and that's also for a rainy day as well. So that's good news. We could probably withstand a loss of about 8 to 10% of the portfolio, I think, before we would use all that money up. So I think that all other things being equal, the rates should be relatively stable because of what the markets will do over the next few years because of that reserve that we have on hand.
I always like to say this, Dan Sara is right now better funded than most California government pension plans up and down the state. We're about in the 75th percentile, which is good. There's a lot of factors for that. One of the factors is that we have recently, up until recently, had a fairly large equity exposure, which equities have done very well over the last 5 years, so we've been very fortunate there. And also, the county issued a pension obligation bond in 1995, and I know that still seems eons or decades away, but we still feel the effects today, and that plays itself out in the funded ratio as well. So this is a graph of Stan Sara's historical funded ratio. You can see a low there of 2009 of 64%. We've been making slow, steady progress since then. 2005 was a high point. I would venture to say that that number was even higher right before the dot-com bubble. Most of the plans up and down the state were 120, 130% funded. So we actually have been even higher than that. But as you can see, we're making progress getting back towards our goal of 100% funding. Just a brief recap of what Stan Sara's investments look like. What you see on the left there is the asset allocation today, and then the pie chart on the right is the long-term asset allocation that Stan Sara is actually gravitating towards. And I think the biggest change you see between today and tomorrow is the allocation to equity. That's going to slowly go away as we put more money into alternative investments. Infrastructure we have yet to fund. We are just now negotiating with our infrastructure manager on terms of that deal. That should probably be done in a couple months, and we will start funding that. There's a $50 million allocation to infrastructure. And we still have a couple percentage points to go on the real estate allocation, and that we should finish up probably in the next couple months. That should be done. And then nothing else major there. We've got a little more we're going to be putting towards fixed income, but I'll talk about that in a little bit. I don't know why the axes on this chart have dropped off, but obviously on the x-axis you have returns, and there should be on the y-axis, on the x-axis there should be years. But I know the 13.4 on the left-hand side, I believe that says 13.4, my eyesight's not as good as it was, but that starts in 1996. That's as far back as I feel that we have reliable data for, is 1996. So what you can see in the middle here is the actuarial assumed discount rate, and that's fluctuated. That was about 8.25% in 1996. It dropped to 8.16. I think it went down to 8%, and now over the last 3 years we've been down to 7.75. So you can see the tremendous volatility in our portfolio relative to what we assume we're going to get. And obviously this is what causes the big swings in funded ratios and employer contribution rates that we all feel when they do happen. Here is a chart that shows the annualized compounded returns that Stan Sara has experienced. That little bullet point on the bottom says 8.1 is the average annual return. That's the average expected discount rate over this 19-year period. So you can compare that 8.1 to the annualized return that we've experienced over these 3, 5, 10, 15, and 19-year intervals. And you can see that over the short run, we've actually beat our actuarial bogey. And over the long run, 19 to 20 years, we've done well as well. But those two periods between 2000 and 2002 and 2008 and 2009 contributed to the subpar performance there in the middle. But I think in the long run, the buy and hold strategy, the ability to stick with the ups and downs of the markets like we saw on the slide before, the markets have rewarded pension plans who have stuck with it. Although I will acknowledge to you today that sometimes those ups and downs are very hard to swallow, and they create tremendous strain on the budgets of local governments up and down the state. And it's a tough thing to deal with. It really is. And staying on that topic, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when it will happen again. And I and promise you, I'm not going to sugarcoat anything, that at some point in time we will experience a year or two of down returns. And so the trick is saving up what you can when the markets are doing well, like we're doing today, hoping that your plan sponsors have the capacity within their budget to increase contributions when the actuary calls for it. It's a balancing item. It's a balancing item between stability and, again, the ability of our plan sponsors to be able to make the contributions when they're called upon. But we are looking at different ways of doing things, and that comes towards the end of the presentation. So talking about the employer contribution rates for fiscal year 15-16, the employer contribution rate, and this is the aggregate, this is across the entire system. So this not only includes the county and the safety and the general plans, but it also includes the city of Ceres and all the special districts that contribute to Stancera. So in the aggregate, the employer contribution rate for Stancera is 23.4%. This represents an increase of about 0.4% over last year. Now, we had a very strong return market-wise between 2013 and 2014. We had above an 18% return. However, we are still paying for losses in the past, and the smoothing method that Stancera employs, they only recognize one-fifth of the gains. So we're only taking one-fifth of, I think it was $140 million was the actual market gain to the plan. We only recognize one-fifth of that and then build that into your rate. That actually reduced your employer contribution rate by about 0.8%. But last year we had the implementation of some new GASB rules, and those GASB rules caused the rate to go up by a little over 2%. And the Stancera Board of Retirement chose to phase that in over 2 years instead of hitting the plan sponsors with a 2.1 or 2.2% increase. Last year, the Board of Retirement chose to phase that in, and they increased the rate last year by 1.1%, and this year is the second half of that that phase-in due to those GASB rules this year. So overall, we actually had an increase in rate because of the GASB phase-in that we had from last year. Employee contribution rates, the new PEPRA tier, those rates change every year. They don't change by much, but they do change every year. That's just by legislation, and then no other changes for all the other employees. All the other employee contribution rates generally only change when the system changes assumptions, but the new PEPRA rules, they do change every year, even though they're very small. So this is a graph of the contribution rate history in millions since 2005. And you can see that the employer contributions to the system have been increasing fairly steadily since 2005, and the employee contribution rates have been relatively flat. Some of that increase is due to the fact that payroll increases naturally over time, but I think the biggest reason for the increases in the recent year is the fact that the actuaries had to increase the employer contribution rates to pay for the investment losses of 2008-2009. So what's coming down the road? I think there's three things that we need to all be aware of that are going to have some upward pressure on the employer contribution rate down the road. There's always this perception that the discount rate is too high. I could argue either side of that argument. I don't think there's anybody here, at least there's nobody that I know that can tell me exactly what the returns are going to be for the portfolio. But nonetheless, there is a perception that public pension plans are having difficulty meeting their assumed rate of return. Stancera is on the high end of the assumed discount rate that we use relative to our peers up and down the state. There is only one 37 Act system, one county plan that's not in CalPERS, one county plan that has a discount rate that's higher than ours, and there's another plan that has a discount rate that's the same as ours. And I expect that some of that pressure may start to affect the Board of Retirement's thinking, and I think that that's going to be an important discussion come next year when the actuary comes to present the new rates, because also every 3 years we do an experience study and we relook at the assumptions, and one of the assumptions is the discount rate, and we've decided the last couple years that we'll just wait and tackle that issue and have that discussion the next time we do an experience study. So I do think that there will be a general push towards a lower interest rate. Now, one of the things that I'd like to see is, instead of perception driving the discount rate down, Stan Sarah is, we're embarking on a de-risking project. Now, when I say de-risking, I mean we're going to slowly start to remove some of the volatility and the equity risk that creates that volatility from the portfolio. I'd like to see, as interest rates start to increase in the economy, because as interest rates start to increase in the economy, it'll be cheaper and cheaper for us to de-risk the portfolio. The Federal Reserve has made it extremely difficult for institutional funds, pension funds in particular, and the elderly, frankly, on fixed incomes to be able to earn a rate of return at a low level of risk. I mean, it's very difficult when I see elderly people that are retired still putting a fair amount of their money into the equity markets, but it's hard to live off of 3-4% a year. Pension plans face the exact same thing. I mean, we can't go out. I'd love to be able to go out and buy bonds and insure the liability payments, but your rates would have to triple at today's interest rates to be able to insure the benefit payments, and it's just, nobody can do that right now. So we are keeping a very keen eye on where interest rates going. We have plans in place, triggers in place that will actually be able to allow us to convert some of the equity into fixed income when it becomes desirable, when it becomes attractive to move money from equity into fixed income at a rate that our plan sponsors can stomach, then we plan on doing that. That, to me, is the best reason to bring down the discount rate, because obviously when you start to invest in these less riskier assets, they're going to pay a lower rate of return, and we're going to have to lower the discount rate commiserately. So at some point in time, for one reason or another, the message that I'm trying to give you is that the interest rate that we assume that the portfolio will make will start to trend downward.
Rick, can you, as you talk about the discount rate, can you just explain for the general public? I know everybody else up here understands the ramifications of that, but if you could explain.
Sure.
Just real quick.
So the actual process is that the actuary selects, with input from the decision makers of the governing body, the actuary selects an interest rate that he or she thinks the portfolio of assets will earn. And that interest rate that he or she selects is a very, very long-term interest rate. It's an interest rate that's is assumed to be in effect for 70, 80, 90 years, because we have folks that are joining the county workforce today at probably very young ages, and they're going to be receiving benefits 80 years down the road. So the actuary has to make this assumption on what the portfolio of assets will earn over a very long period of time. And so the actuaries don't look at what the capital markets are doing today. They try to predict what the capital markets are going to do over the very long term. And so if the lower discount rate you choose, the lower interest rate you choose, means that more money will have to come into the plan from some other source. Because if you're not earning that much money from your investments, the benefits are what they are. The benefits are whatever somebody's going to get. There's nothing that's going to change that amount other than cost of living increases. But since we know what the benefits are going to be, and we calculate what the expected return on the portfolio is going to be, the lower your return is, the more money you have to go seek from the employees and the employer. And so the lower discount rate means a higher liability value and less money coming into the plan from the investments. And there's a general rule of thumb that when you lower, and this is a fairly good rule of thumb based on my experience, when you lower the discount rate, the assumed rate of return on the portfolio by 0.25%, that increases employer contribution rates by about 2% of pay. So if we were to lower the expected return down to 6.75%, the plan sponsors would be looking at anywhere from a 7-10% increase in their contribution rate in 1 year, which is why a lot of these plans, when they embark down the path of lowering the discount rate, they do it in very, very small doses. So does that kind of explain?
Yeah, that's good. So then that equates to the employer being Stanislaus County, the taxpayer would have to put more money.
Absolutely.
To fund this, more money coming out of our general fund.
That's great. The employee would pay a little more because, again, when you change assumptions, that's when the employer rates change. But for the most part, the employer is going to be on the hook for the greatest portion of that amount.
But
Question, wouldn't the best projection of future rate of return be your history? And we're sitting at average at 8.1%, yet you dropped the 7.75% discount rate. It just seems like there's only one purpose of that, and that's to get more money from the employer.
By having a lower discount rate?
Yeah.
Well, I think that
drive up the rates.
I don't think that anybody's doing that on purpose. I don't think we're saying let's stick it to the employer.
Well, and not stick it to the employer, but the more money you have in the fund, you have more money to manage with greater expectation of returns. And so, yeah, so, I mean, sitting in your position, you want the most money and you can in that account so that you can then invest more money and get more earnings. But it's killing us on the taxpayer side.
But I also want you to be able to make these contributions. That's what I'm saying. It's a balance between benefit security, having enough money on hand, and having you guys be able to make these contributions. So it's a balancing act, really, and it's not an easy one. But to your point on historical returns, you also have to temper your historical returns with what you think the capital market expectations are going to give out today and later on down the road. And I know that after 2008, 2009, there was a lot of talk that capital market expectations have changed, that we've entered a new regime is what the word was, and we're not going to be able to expect the returns that the equity markets have been giving us, and productivity levels are going to be down, and those are going to drive down investment returns as well. So you do have to temper going forward, you have to temper what you've done in the past with what you think the markets still are going to be delivering going forward, and you have to kind of make some assumptions on inflation as well, which definitely have an impact on the real rate of return that the fund earns. So it's not an easy thing to do. If anybody tells you that they know exactly what the discount rate should be, they're wrong. Nobody can tell you what it is. And I don't know whether it should be higher or lower. I kind of feel the way you do. It's hard for me to go to my board members with this right here and say, let's lower the discount rate to 7.5%. Because the first thing somebody's going to say, obviously, is, well, geez, you guys have earned 8%. Why would you want to do something like that? It's a difficult thing to do, but being the conservative person I am, and you know, balancing that employer contribution rate with benefit security, I'd like to get something that makes everybody feel good. But it's not easy to do.
Can I ask you, how does the interest rate assumption affect your rate of return? There's a formula there where we have to estimate what the inflation rate is, too.
So the expected return on the assets, the discount rate, doesn't affect what you're going to earn. So I don't know if I understood your question correctly. In other words, when you set an expectation for the return on assets, that has nothing to do with what you're going to earn later on down the road.
We also assume a inflation rate, too.
Correct.
And there's a correlation between that and the rate of return.
There is. So if you were to lower your inflation expectations, then if you didn't adjust the real, there's two components. I think we actually talked about this a couple of years ago when I was here. There's two components to the assumed rate of return. It's the inflation component and the real rate of return. And without getting into the math, because this is not exactly correct, but it's good enough for our discussion today, the sum of those two pieces equals the interest rate, the discount rate that you would use. So if you lower your inflation assumption and you want to keep the same discount rate, then you're making an implication that your real rate of return has gone up. So if you generally, what happens though is when you lower your inflation assumption, then you lower the discount rate as well. The real return doesn't really change, so the whole thing comes down. One of the beautiful, I shouldn't say beautiful, one of the nice things about the inflation assumption is that there are some offsetting effects to the inflation assumption, because when you lower the inflation assumption, yes, your overall assumed rate of return goes down, but also your pay increases should not increase as rapidly as well. So the actuary will lower the assumed pay increases that employees will get, and even more importantly, the actuary will lower the expected future cost of living payments to the retirees, which actually generally brings the liabilities down. So getting to your point, a lot of times when the systems up and down the state look at lowering the discount rate, they focus strictly on the inflation assumption because it really mitigates some of the effect of of a lower discount rate.
So, Rick, when you gave that formula of a 0.25% change in the discount rate is equivalent to about 2%.
That's an inflation assumption.
That's on the inflation side or the real rate of return?
No, that's the inflation. If you lower the real rate of return, you'd probably be looking at a 3% increase in the employer contribution rate. And then here's another big thing. The Society of Actuaries about 2 years ago started this study, and they started looking at mortality, obviously how long people are living, and they did a very in-depth study, something that they haven't done ever since I've been an actuary. And what the actuaries are now recommending and what all the systems up and down the state are doing is they're not just assuming that people are living longer, but they're assuming that mortality will improve over time. And so, for instance, let's say a 50-year-old today is expected to live another 35 years, that's good enough, to age 85. The actuaries are now saying you need to build in mortality improvements. So in 20 years from now, that 30-year-old today, who will be 50 years old 20 years from now, may be expected to live to 88 years old, which is a very valid assumption. They've got tremendous amounts of empirical data to back this assumption up. So this is something that we will be looking at next year. Probably about half of the plans up and down the state have already adopted improved mortality assumptions. And the bad news is that that's about an average 4-5% increase in the employer contribution rate when that actually hits. Now, one of the good things is that the systems also have been implementing this rate increase in phases, which I'm assuming that our Board of Retirement will probably do as well. So we're not going to hit you with the entire 4-5% right at once. We'll phase that in, like we did the GASB methodology change last year. But that's definitely coming. I don't think there's really any way around it. The fact is, people are living longer. Mortality is improving, which translates into benefit payments being paid for a longer period of time, which means more money needs to be on hand to pay these benefits. So I kind of just hit on this. If you look at the discount rate, the mortality, we're probably looking at 6-8% of pay over the next 2-4 years. That could be higher or lower depending on what the investments actually do. I read a lot, listen to a lot of TV in the morning, and starting to get the sense that some people are thinking that the equity markets are going to start to flatten out a little bit, maybe. I think that there'll be opportunities internationally because the European banks are now embarking down a path that this country has been doing for the last 4 or 5 years, and quantitative easing, and they're lowering interest rates down to zero. So I have a feeling there will be some more opportunities in the international market, and I think you'll see money moving out of the domestic markets into the international markets over the next few years. And I expect that Stansara will probably do some of that as well. And just a couple things really fast. Some of the things we're doing, Stansara is really focusing on compliance, transparency, and governance. We are implementing risk. We're monitoring our managers more. We're monitoring the risk that they're taking. We're going to be doing projected employer rate modeling, giving different scenarios, investment scenarios, and we're going to be stressing our portfolio, maybe subjecting it to 2008-2009 scenarios and see where that leaves us funded ratio-wise and employer contribution rate-wise and try to head those things off at the pass. We will, as an organization and the board, will be receiving information not so much from a return-centric world like we have in the past, but we're going to be focusing a lot more on risk and much less on return. And also, like I mentioned, we are implementing compliance issues where we are going to be paying closer attention to our managers, making sure that they're abiding with our investment policy statements, how much hedging and leverage that they can use in the portfolio, and we're going to be watching that. And we've actually already started reporting how much value these managers are truly adding. In the past, we've just looked at how well they've done relative to their benchmark. Now We are looking at how well they're doing relative to their benchmark, but we're reducing what we have to pay them to be able to achieve that. And so we are going to be focusing more on manager compliance and truly how much value they're adding to the portfolio. And that's all I have for you today. I'd be happy to answer any more questions.
Have you got any more questions of Rick? Supervisor DiMartini.
Yeah, I had a few. I'm pretty familiar with what you're doing here. You know, you mentioned PEPRA, you know, but it's like going to a STANCOG meeting where people really don't know what the acronym is. I know the members of the board up here probably do, but you just give us a little thumbnail explanation of what you mean by PEPRA.
Sure. I apologize. PEPRA stands for Pension Employee Retirement Public Retirement Act, and what it is the governor and the legislature in 2012 crafted legislation that actually implemented a lower set of benefits going forward. It started January 1st, 2013. It was not a choice. There was no choice. Every system up and down the state had to do it, and which actually created a level playing field. One of the things that it didn't really help, unfortunately, didn't really help Stan Sarah much, because I believe it was 2011, if I remember, I wasn't here then, but I think it was 2011 when the county implemented a Tier 2, and the benefit factors are very close to what the Pension Reform Act is. So it hasn't done a whole lot for us. One of the good things that it did do, though, it redefined the elements that you can put into one's compensation to count towards how you calculate your pension benefit. And one of the things that I really would commend the Board of Retirement for is that we were one of only two systems that actually chose for new members to include base pay only in the calculation of the pensionable compensation. Every other state and the big boys in the room, CalPERS, chose to continue to include all the special pay items. And this board decided not to, and there was actually, I think, a flattering article in the LA Times a few months ago about us and Contra Costa, two systems that actually didn't do that. And I think it was a wise idea. I really do.
And even the managers, I don't know, just you mentioned that we had them, but we have quite a few in Stan Sarah's system, and you could explain to our audience how we monitor these people and actually knock on their door and visit them once in a while.
There is a lot that we do. There's a lot more to do, and there's a lot of issues that we're tackling right now, a lot of processes that we're putting in place to do that. What we generally do is we look at our managers' performance not only on a monthly basis but on a quarterly basis. We look at how much value they're adding. We look at if they're going outside their risk boundary. They all have risk budgets. And then if we decide as a board, the board decides that their performance is subpar, then what we do is we actually put them on watch. And they'll be on watch for a while until they clean up their act. And if they don't clean up their act, we get rid of them and hire somebody else. But during the year also, we actually go out and visit. We go on site to these managers and we visit them. We come with our guns loaded with questions to ask based on performance, based on any changes we see in their organization. And we do that every year. We're going to be doing that in June this year. We have an East Coast trip planned. But it's just part of the due diligence process. It's an ongoing process. It never ends. You never can get comfortable with any manager, no matter how well they're doing. And you always have to be knocking on their doors and asking them questions, which I got to tell you that probably 70% of my job, 75% of my job is spent on manager compliance. It truly is. It's I spend so much time on the phone with these guys. I spend time looking at the numbers that, the numbers that they're producing and trying to make sense of them. And a lot of their reports that they give us are very difficult to understand. And I just sent somebody back east to Florida for 1 week, our accountant, to make sure that we understand these reports that we're getting from our direct lenders, some of our alternative investments, because I can't figure them out. And so we are making great strides to be able to understand really what's going on behind the scenes and make sure that we're not paying too much in fees, because a lot of these managers command a heck of a lot of money throughout the year. And it has to be worth it for us to be able to continue to give them our money. It has to be worth it in terms of how much risk they're actually taking. and how much return they're actually adding above a bogey or a benchmark that we measure them against. So,
I guess one last thing, and the you said we're in the 75th percentile. That's throughout the state, or the just the 37 ACT counties?
No, that's throughout the state. That's up in
that's CalPERS and STRS and all that. Have any idea how we're doing with the other 37 ACT counties in comparison?
My guess would be we probably would be relatively in the same 75th percentile, because even though CalPERS is big, their funded ratio is very close to, I mean, if you think about it, they set the 50th percentile for the entire state of California because they're so big. So they're the ones that dictate what that 50th percentile is. So I would imagine that we're still pretty close. We're still 75th percentile even among 37 ACT systems. What I can tell you is that there is a tremendous variance amongst 37 ACT systems in terms of funder ratio. There's actually one plan, Fresno City, which is not a 37 ACT system, but they are one of the incorporated systems that are included in all 37 ACT data. They are actually 105% funded. And there is one system that's in the low 60s still, a 37 ACT county system that's in the low 60s.
Is that Merced?
That's Merced.
Okay, that's all I have.
Supervisor O'Brien.
Okay, so right now we're at about 24 cents on every dollar for payroll that employers paying into retirement. Is that what
yes.
that slide was? Okay.
Correct.
So now the million-dollar question. As we budget out 5 years in advance, what do you see that number climbing to once you add in mortality, discount rate, GASB? So, I mean, if I was adding those up, that's like 33, 35.
I'd say you're looking at low 30s, 32%, 33%.
That's just an important number. Right now we're paying 24 cents for every dollar we pay in salary. We pay 24 cents in retirement. That's going to jump to 32, 33 cents.
I will comment that we try to work pretty closely with Stan Sarah to make sure that our long-range model reflects projections, and we appreciate, Rick, your willingness to help us do better long-term modeling so that we can make sure that we're creating capacity for those increases. And the question was being asked, what does 1% increase in payroll represent? I think as a rough rule, it's going to be a little over $2 million for our organization, probably about half of that to the general fund.
One thing I'd like to leave you with, the biggest threat to the system is the another market scenario like we saw in 2008, 2009. That is the biggest threat. You know, I think we can handle, you know, a 3% return, a 0% return, then a 10% return. We can handle that. But when you get these large 40% drops in the portfolio, it gets extremely difficult to stomach. And that's when I don't like this, but that's when the actuary has to come along and do his magic and kind of do the best he can to smooth rates out, and I hope we don't see that scenario. I hope interest rates rise to a point to where we can start to remove meaningfully some of the risk of the portfolio before we get to a point where the markets drop 40%. Because again, and I'm a positive person by nature, but I can almost guarantee you that at some point in time, something systemic will happen again with the economy, and we will see it again. It's just that's the way people are. All right.
Very good, Rick. Thank you. And just to Stan's point there, so on those percentages we talked about there, we're talking $15 million more, of which about half hits our general fund here. So I know a lot of people's eyes are glassed over at this point as we finish this up, but it is so important to our budget in our planning as we talk about here what's going to happen here with the returns. I also want to point out Supervisor DeMartini is our representative on Stan Sarah and has been for years and does just a great job there, as the whole board does there at Stan Sarah. Just what you guys do is you're doing a great job, and it's just so important to the county and our budget. So we thank you for being here.
Thank you all.
Thank you. Okay. Very good. So now we go to public comment. Okay. And I have three cards here today, and the first one here is, and public comment again is anything that's not on our agenda. 5 minutes to speak, and our first one up is Adrian Harrell. Adrian, come on up. How are you, Adrian?
Evening.
Thanks for being here.
Mr. Chairman, honorable supervisors, ladies and gentlemen of the gallery, good evening and happy St. Patrick's Day. My name is Adrian Harrell, and I am the owner and CEO of Newbridge Management. As a property management company, I manage the real estate portfolios of investors here in the county. The total of the portfolio that we currently manage is close to $100 million in the county. But the reason why I'm here this evening is because I am not only a city, but I'm also a county volunteer. I'm the president of Modesto Sister Cities International. Modesto Sister Cities International manages the city as well as the county's relationship with its seven sister cities, as well as one county across the globe. Our sister cities are in Vernon, Canada, Aguascalientes, Mexico, Laval, France, Khmelnytsky, Ukraine, Vijayawada, India, and Kurume in Japan. Currently, we have a moratorium on our sister city with China, which is in Mengzi in the Henan province. Our one sister county is with Laval, the county of La Mayenne, in France, the département de La Mayenne in France. The goal of Sister Cities International is to build bridges across national borders, as well as promote Modesto, as well as Stanislaus County, not only on the local, but also national, as well as international level. To date, some of the programs that we have been participating in have included the Trilateral Exchange Program, as well as the Open World Program. The Trilateral Exchange Program gave us the opportunity to be one of the six cities across the country to participate and have students from Modesto, Mexico, as well as Canada, Canada, U.S., as well as Mexico, to participate in a program that allowed them to study how the various countries deal with poverty as well as environmental issues. Some of our students that have participated in our exchange programs have gone on to universities such as Harvard, UC Davis, UC Berkeley, UC Irvine, UCLA, as well as CSU Long Beach. The reason why I'm here is to reintroduce the sister county relationship. I know that this relationship has been going on for years. For approximately 24 to 25 years, we have had a standing relationship with our sister county of La Mayenne in France. That is something that has become a hidden secret, unfortunately, and I just wanted to bring it to light and to help promote some of the things that we do. I do want to go back and talk about also a little bit about the Open World Program, which I omitted to mention. The Open World Program is where the city of Modesto and the surrounding area hosts former Soviet country elected leaders here locally so that they can learn about our form of government. It is a congressionally funded program, and we host those delegates here in our region. But the sister county relationship extends far beyond just the county relationship. It's also our city relationship. About 5 years ago, we extended our relationship and became a sister city. The city of Laval became our sixth sister city. Often individuals wonder what it is that we do, but I wanted to kind of point out one of the companies that was a very small company by the name of Beignet that had its headquarters in the city of Turlock not too long ago. So then that company later on became Lactalis. Lactalis is the largest dairy producer in all of Europe, and they used to have their headquarters in Turlock. Unfortunately, somewhere in the early 2000s, that company relocated its operations to Wisconsin, and that went away from us. Their largest product, well-known product that is in our grocery stores is the President Cheese, which is the President Brie, and as well as Camembert cheese that is very familiar to many people that do shop in our local groceries. The reason why I'm here is that I wanted to reintroduce the program and to let you know that there's a group of volunteers within the county that work very hard to facilitate the relationship between the various countries, and also to bring to your attention that we have a strong interest from our counterparts in the county of La Mayenne to reestablish our relationship with France. Last year, we had a small delegation that visited us, our county here, and they would like to officially send another delegation to the city of Modesto so that they can re-explore or reintroduce not only the relationship, but also explore possible business relationships. One of the gentlemen that was president, he said he was very forthcoming in saying, you know, we have a small company that produces cheese, which was Lactalis, the largest company in Europe. He said cheese goes very well with that small manufacturer that produces wine in your area. And Gallo, as you very well know, it is the largest wine and producer of spirits in the world. So they would like to come back and possibly explore opportunities between our counties. And that's all I have for you.
Very good. Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, next up, we have Laura Sexton. Hi, Laura, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good.
I live in District 4, and the reason I'm here is I am investigating the feasibility of getting solar on my home, which used to be my grandparents' 1940 home, maiden name Morrow, near Morrow Road, north of Kernan. The old terminology was Greenbelt area, if you will, north of Kernan. Anyway, the city of Modesto informs me that the HERO program, Home Energy Opportunity Program, Opportunity, something like that, anyway, is not available to county residents, specifically 95356. And I'm wondering if it's been investigated by the county, if you guys have done a feasibility study. I don't know what the incentive would be to have the county involved with this program, but I know the homeowners would have a tax incentive and as well as a tax rebate, but that rebate is dwindling and maybe gone in about a month. So I'm just wondering if it's been researched by the county, if it's $2,000 possibly for the county. I'm not really sure. So,
and I don't know, Stan, if you want to speak to that. We have looked at this. Go ahead.
Yeah, we've had considerable discussions because in some ways I guess we're a minority in some government agencies, but part of our reluctance is in essence, HERO is about taking private construction loans and funding them where the county becomes a collection agency through the property tax bill. And one of our concerns is by very nature of collecting it on the property tax bill, it becomes it makes the mortgage, in essence, in a junior position because taxes always get paid first, even before mortgage delinquencies do. So consequently, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and others have taken a position of not supporting either the HERO or the PACE programs because the fact that it puts them in a vulnerable position from a mortgage lender. I think another concern that at least I have personally expressed is that people over time will forget that this was their private construction loan and view it as a property tax. And the reality is then it gobbles up, in essence, taxing capacity on the part of the public because they feel like they already are paying a higher tax burden on their tax bills. So for those reasons, in discussions I've had individually with board members, at this point we have not been inclined to adopt or embrace the HERO program. Based on board policy, that could change, but that's currently been the county's position.
Okay, let's do a hypothetical. If there was no mortgage on the home, would there be exceptions made or anything?
I don't know that we have the ability from a government to make that type of distinction. Mm-hmm. The other thing we would offer, my kids recently put in a solar project on their home, and they just did it through normal private financing. So it's not like there aren't alternatives to people who want to explore these types of construction activities.
Sure. I just wanted to check everything out, all my, dot all my T's.
I hope that helps answer
right.
your question.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Laura. Thanks for coming up. Okay, and the final card that I have here is Joe Gorno? Gorno. How are you, Joe?
Good, how are you?
Good.
I'm also here regarding the HERO program, and I'm actually here because of Mrs. Sexton. Forgive me, I'm not a public speaker. I haven't spoken since high school, so I may black out. So.
No, I do it all the time.
Yeah, we're doing the same thing.
That's okay, you're doing
good. You've got to fall back.
No, you're doing good.
I'm an Eagle Scout. I am a veteran, and I find a huge fulfillment in helping people, and helping people like Mrs. Sexton. And I am also an electrical contractor based out of North Modesto here in the county. And I've been installing solar systems since 2005. And one of the greatest fulfillments in my job is to be able to give people the ability to gain control over their energy needs. And I understand that there's a lot of, you know, politics, and there's a lot of uncertainty about the tax bills, and that is duly taken. But there's a lot of reasons why I believe that the HERO program offers a new opportunity for jurisdictions to be able to allow homeowners to get into a solid program to be able to gain control over their energy needs without having to go into a lease program, which a lot of the nation is really getting pushed into. And a lot of those lease programs are not to the benefit of the consumer. So the HERO program, I'm just going to kind of recap. The HERO program is a home efficiency home loan that is paid through the homeowners through their property taxes. It can be used to pay for home efficiency improvements such as windows, roofing, HVAC systems, electrical service changes, solar systems, and a whole lot more. Even artificial turf can be purchased to help drought conditions. This program allows homeowners to do these upgrades to their homes with no money down. A lot of people cannot afford to make these improvements to their homes. As an electrical contractor, I can see a lot of even service changes where there's unlisted service panels that they don't no longer make anymore that have been deemed as a fire hazard. But to change your service at your home, dealing with the utility company as well as building department, it's an expensive process. It could be as low as $1,800, or it could be as high as $10,000 or $15,000, depending on how far you have to go to get the new wires to the new service. That's just one example that I deal with. The program would allow them to spend less money on their energy costs with no money out of pocket if they have adequate equity in their home. Having a program like HERO that allows more consumers to do home efficiency improvements would benefit the county because of it would increase revenues through additional building permits. A lot of homeowners that do not have the ability to go out and spend $3,000 for a service change, or you know $18,000 or $15,000 or $12,000 for a solar electric system that's going to be able to generate power right on their site, and hedge against future increases in energy prices, they would be able to do that right with no money down. But it would be increased revenues through building permits. It would also improve unemployment rates as small businesses like the one I own that has 6 employees, because we would have to hire more staff to handle increased projects. Just with the jurisdictions that I've dealt with the HERO program, I'm going to have to probably double my crew just because it opens up that much more opportunity, not only for us, but for the homeowners as well. And these are just a few reasons, but the last reason is going back to one of my purposes in life is to help people. I believe that everyday people do improvements to their home to save them money and give them control over their energy needs like Mrs. Sexton is helping people. And I really believe in that mission. The growing communities that are accepting HERO, as you stated before, there's a lot of them out there, and it's growing every day. In fact, I live in the city of Oakdale, and I will personally be using the HERO program to put solar on my own home in the coming weeks. So while I'm not an expert on all the every detail of the HERO program, I do strongly believe that in the end, it helps people gain freedom through high energy bills, from higher energy bills. It increases jobs that we need to increase, and it will increase revenues for the county. So I invite the Board of Supervisors to welcome the HERO program to the county. Thank you.
Go ahead, Supervisor Keza.
Joe, you did a great job, by the way.
I didn't black out.
Yeah, you didn't. Thank you for serving our country. Appreciate that. I there's not a lot of what you said that I don't agree with. I want you to know, and don't think that we're against green energy. You as Stan had talked about, we're in a poor area, and I know it's been really successful because I get around the state quite a bit in other areas, especially the more affluent areas, and we have a concern for our citizens. And they're trying, there's a move afoot in Washington to try and make some changes so that they don't take a superior position to Fannie and Freddie, maybe lowering their interest rates. There's a few other concerns that we have, but it's something that I think will get fixed. I really do, and appreciate what you're doing. Just at this time that we've talked about it, it's just not, until those things are fixed, we feel like we have to protect our constituents.
So, I understand that, and thank you very much for your time. Yeah.
Thank you, Joe.
Thanks, Joe. Great job. Okay. Now, I appreciate everybody waiting around. Normally, consent calendars does not take this long to get to, but it's time for consent calendar. Is there anything on anybody would like to pull any item that's on consent? Anybody in the audience like to pull any item that's on consent? Very good. Do I have a motion?
I would like to make a motion to approve all consent calendar.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
I'll second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Pass 5-0. Very good. I'm sorry, I did cut off public comment. Was there anybody else that wanted to make a comment that didn't turn in a card? Okay. Good. Very good.
One of you wants to comment.
Okay.
Are you guys, your teacher making you come here?
Yeah. So where are you guys from? What class? What school are you from? Very good.
Welcome.
Welcome. Thanks for being here. I hope this has been very educational here today. Everyone gets an A for being here today. Okay. Okay, let's move on to correspondence.
This board has received a notice from the California Cultural and Historical Endowment regarding the new museum grant program for small capital projects in museums.
Referral to the Department of Parks and Recreation and the Chief Executive Office.
This board has received the claims as noted on the agenda.
Acknowledge receipt of claims and refer to the Chief Executive Office Risk Management Division. Any Board of Supervisor reports? None. Legislative Fiscal Management Report.
I just wanted to put a shout out to a group that this past Saturday, under the leadership of Chris Guptill, did a Tuolumne River cleanup. They call themselves the 9 to 99. Supervisor Kiz and I had a chance to kind of preview the area before they cleaned it up last Friday. Some of the homeless encampments and pit bulls and there were over 75 volunteers. Our public works department showed up in force with some heavy equipment, and they really transformed that area. So really appreciate the community stepping up. And I was going to announce today was the launch of a new initiative sponsored by Stanislaus County Office of Education, the Stanislaus Community Foundation, and a number of other partners, including our library, called Stanislaus Reads. Supervisor O'Brien was there as well today. An exciting initiative about helping ensure that more children in this area are at grade level reading by the time they hit their third grade. They've determined that third grade is that transition point where you go from learning to read to reading to learn. And if you haven't mastered that skill of reading, you can easily get left behind. So new exciting initiative, I think, very much aligns with our prevention initiative And so we're very excited to see that launch today. And in the future, I'm going to try to start bringing you a little more progress reports and where we're at on the focus on prevention. But we're hoping to bring, I think, on the 31st, Patrice, kind of an update of our activities, get your blessing on a contract, and then we'll report to you on a regular basis moving forward as we get this effort going full steam. That concludes my report.
Very good. Thank you. If there's nothing else, this meeting is adjourned.